Welcome to everyone this evening, and our topic for tonight is Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, Great Readings from Great Minds. First, on the first page, just a very brief outline of Rabbi Soloveitchik's life. He was born in Poland. He lived kind of in poverty. I guess my great grandfather didn't do the greatest job in fundraising, so Rabbi Soloveitchik often had his pants were the wrong size and things like that. But his father was rabbi in different places and had some students, and his grandfather was very famous for having created a new approach that he created in his yeshiva in Brisk, approach of analytical Talmud, where they were less interested in the particular questions on a particular line of Talmud and more interested in the concepts. And they did it often through a dialectic, through the challenge of answering a contradiction in Maimonides' writings. And through that contradiction, they could see that there were two elements that they were discussed. There was this side and the other side. And this sort of analytical approach was something that Rabbi Soloveitchik Jr., Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, developed even further and in various parts of the Talmud. He had studied until he was about 20. He studied with almost exclusively with his father. The story was that when he was a young man, he was sent to yeshiva, and they were teaching too much Tanya. It was a Chabad rabbi, and that was not what his father wanted. So his father decided he would teach him by himself, and that was the greatest thing. They studied oodles and oodles of tractates together, and one year he was actually able to study with his grandfather, Chaim Soloveitchik, because Chaim moved to Warsaw, where they were. And he had other figures who influenced him, but eventually he made his way to the University of Berlin, where he received a PhD in the writings of Hermann Cohen, who was a great philosopher at that time. And then when he comes to America, he establishes himself in Boston. He has a great conflict with the Kashrut there in Boston. They gave him a hard time. And he was able to make it through that, eventually establish with his wife, established the Maimonides School there in Boston, but he did have a brief yeshiva there in Boston, and that's where Rabbi Nathan Greenblatt studied in that little yeshiva when he was in high school, went to that yeshiva, and his cousin, Rabbi Michal Feinstein, cousin of the famous Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, who was also Rabbi Soloveitchik's cousin, those two rabbis, Rabbi Michal and he, studied together. Those of you who know Marty Lazar, his brother, so enamored through Rabbi Greenblatt of Rabbi Michal that he, from the time he left America, until Rabbi Michal passed away a few years ago, this Marty's brother studied with Rabbi Michal. That's what he did full time. In any event, then he comes to Yeshiva University as the chief lecturer of the highest class, taught many smicha students throughout the generations from 1940, 41, all the way until 96 or so, when I had him for his last 2.5 years. He was just too ill, and he was had a lot of physical problems that made it difficult for him to give a shiur. So last number of years he spent kind of recluse in his home back in Boston with his daughter, who was married to Rabbi Tursky from Harvard Judaic Studies program. So let's make our way to the actual booklet itself. We have a jam-packed evening of readings. So first, he makes a private confession and a footnote here in On Repentance. He has very interesting discussion about the difficulty in conveying tradition. And then we'll look at some passages where he tries to convey tradition. And how do you convey concepts that are hard to convey, that are more emotional? He was very much interested in the varieties of religious experience and the idea of existentialism, of trying to describe the human condition. And in that sense, to transmit not just the Talmudic knowledge, which was the bread and butter of what he taught, but also to convey not just the philosophy, but the experience of Jewish life. Just a little bibliography before we get started in the reading. In his early years, he wrote this Halachic Mind, which sort of like you would expect someone in their senior year of college or during graduate school to write a book like this, where every line is a quotation from some book he recently read, a philosophy book, or some jargon from philosophy class, which makes it almost impossible to read if you're not philosophically oriented. So that was his very first book, Halachic Mind. Then A Lonely Man of Faith was written fairly early on and described really, as we'll see later, philosophy of the modern man who we would hope would attempt to be both religious persona, but also a person of science and a person of interest in developing the world, as well as sitting back and appreciating the world. He wrote Halachic Man, where some say is a biography of his grandfather, Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, explaining the philosophy of halacha. In Hebrew, it's called Ish HaHalacha. In the back of this Hebrew version, there are also a beautiful treatise called the Vikashtem Misham, a more spiritual treatise, where he describes the halacha as the coming together of God's will and our will. I want to do what God wants me to do. And he also has some beautiful comments on prayer.
Vikashtem
Misham, and from there you shall seek, is in English. I'm sorry, I didn't have a chance to bring that English volume here. But yes, it is, and it's very beautiful. The thoughts on prayer, I believe you can get in English too these days. Then one of the first students to come out with something was Rabbi Bezdin Alva Shalom, who wrote the Reflections of the Rav. So he wrote up in his own words some beautiful thoughts for our salvation. We'll see something later. And a volume two as well. And then his great student, Rabbi Schechter, to live and be well, wrote several volumes of Nefesh HaRav, Pnimei HaRav, which give a lot of halachic positions and also thoughts on Chumash. In the magazine Tradition, he wrote a lot of articles. For instance, this particular volume, in volume 17, number 2 of Tradition, it's all Rabbi Soloveitchik, and some of his major articles appeared here. He wrote his student, an admirer of his, Pinchas Peli, a professor in Israel, wrote up in Hebrew, and then it was translated into English, his thoughts on repentance, a collection of different essays. In many ways, this is one of his most beautiful works in that he combines his philosophy and his halachic analysis, the legal analysis, all in one. Another student of his, Rabbi Rakefet, who teaches a lot of seminaries and schools in Israel, wrote up a two-volume sort of storybook of different stories, of different things he said about different things, and a lot of fun. Rabbi Rakefet, it's always lots of fun. There are smaller volumes that the Zionist World Organization put out, Devei Hagut, about when he talks about Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, gives some Kabbalistic foray. He was not non-Kabbalistic. He was able to deal in all realms of Jewish life, including Kabbalah. But they say that his Kabbalistic references, his mystical references, were mostly sort of put it down to earth type of references. Other Divrei Hashkafa, other collections of essays. There were some students of his. Some people don't like them. Whatever halachic positions of the Rav by Aaron Ziegler. Some people don't like it. Some people do. Rabbi J.J. Schechter and others put out a number of volumes. This is just two examples. Emergence of Ethical Man, Worship of the Heart. This is very much about prayer, and some of his ideas on prayer are here. It's something called Family Redeemed, where we talk about family relationships. It's a wonderful, more practical volume. The Five Addresses, in Hebrew and English, where he talks about Zionism, his coming to Zionism. And his halachic works are still coming out. One of his students, Rabbi Shurkin, came out with incredible three volumes that make his learning really accessible to yeshiva students. I'm afraid it's not in English. And these are also not in English, but his annual lectures. His annual lectures drew about over 1,000 people. In those days, to have 1,000 people gathering about Torah in 1975 was a very, very big deal. So some of it's in memory of his father, some of it's by his father, and extensive essays where, you know, masterful essays weaving together all kinds of stuff. So there's more and more of his books, and they're still coming out. The Soloveitchik tradition was he didn't publish much. His grandfather, who was supposed to be this great authority, he only had really sort of one book, you know. But the Briskers, the people in that yeshiva, they believe you didn't need many books, but you need to know them well and analyze them well. So let's read that first paragraph on the footnote here of his private confession about the difficulty in conveying the essence of the religious experience from a Jewish perspective. Who would like to read that? If you have good vision, then...
(clears throat)
What is the medium?
No. From the bottom.
Oh, footnote.
Yes.
Allow me, please, to make a private confession concerning a matter that has caused me much loss of sleep. I'm not very old, yet I remember a time when 90% of world Jewry were observant, and the secularists were a small minority of the princes of the camp. I still remember, it was not so long ago, when Jews were still close to God and lived in an atmosphere pervaded with holiness. But today, what do we see? The profane and secular are in control wherever we turn. Even those neighborhoods which made up predominantly of religious Jews, one can no longer talk of the sanctity of the Shabbat day. True, there are Jews in America who observe the Sabbath. The label Sabbath observer has come to be used as a title of honor in our circles, just like the Rav Hagam. Neither really indicates anything, and both testify to the worldly state of our generation. But it is not for the Shabbat that my heart aches. It is for the forgotten eve of the Sabbath. There are Sabbath-observing Jews in America, but they are not Eve of the Sabbath Jews who go out to greet the Sabbath with beating hearts and pulsating souls. There are many who observe the precepts with their hands and with their feet and or with their mouths, but there are few indeed who truly know the meaning of the service of the heart. What is the percentage of religious Jews today in contrast to the 90%? Only two generations ago. It seems to me that religious Jewry survives today solely by the force of the name of God, who is there after man's sins. Otherwise, we should have utterly despaired and given in to this feeling, with which I am often overcome as I lie awake at night, that we are building castles of sand, and any moment a wave will come and wipe out everything. But God, who is there after man's sins, does not allow us to despair. He whispers in our ears that Jerusalem is surrounded by mountains. One must do much climbing and work hard, grasp every handhold and outcropping, slide backwards and try again to climb the mountain so as to be able to reach Jerusalem. We shall climb the mountain unto the Lord. I do not believe that it is easy to return and repent. The path of repentance for the individual as well as the community is arduous, and many boulders are strewn about which we can be overcome only with supreme effort. The road is long and tortuous until one arrives at the stage of the cleansing before the Lord, the cleansing of the name of God who was there before me.
So here you can see a man longing for a world that no longer exists. In many ways, he was a man of two worlds. He grew up in one world, then he went to Berlin, which is another world. Then he came to America, which is a third world. He's trying to bridge that gap. And how do you convey not just the religious practice and the religious thinking and the intellectual ideas that he's very much drawn to, but also the religious feeling? And he said the Erev Shabbos is what's lacking, that feeling of, oh, it's Erev Shabbos, and my grandmother, oh, Pesach is coming, oh, you gotta get worried, you gotta get nervous, you gotta do something about it, Shabbos is coming, Pesach is coming. That, right, many Jews today try to avoid that sort of stuff and have someone else do it or what, but it's the stuff of which, the longing for Shabbos, which he doesn't have. And you see that he sort of wonders, you know, can we recreate that in America? It turned out that he had a lot of help from the yeshiva world, and the YU world also exploded. But it was a little bit despairing in the 50s or what. It was worrisome. You know, would the Torah world be recreated? Some of your parents, you know, worried about these things as well. Thank God today we're doing much better. But just one other thought. Yes.
The writing style in this footnote is so beautiful and mellifluous, and it's in contrast to the writing style in like Halachic Man that I tried to read and I couldn't really get through it. Is this more typical or is that more typical?
When he tried to write he was very much a stickler for detail, and therefore didn't publish a lot. He left more in his draw than he did publish. So he was very nervous about publishing, and he wanted it to be absolute quality. So he reworked and reworked so many different things. You wonder sometimes whether some of these different volumes that you have are just reworkings of the same book. A lot of them have sort of overlaps. So when people quote what he was just saying, or in this little footnote, it's more conversational. That was one thing. But when he was trying to write his, you know, magnum opus, like The Lonely Man of Faith, the vocabulary comes flying, and we don't know what's going on. As one of my teachers said, when he spoke in Yiddish, you could understand what he was saying if you speak Yiddish. When he spoke in English, nobody had any idea, because my teacher liked to say he swallowed the dictionary live. So there was no way. You know,
so this is more like this conversation.
More like conversation. So speaking of conversation, yes?
I just wanted to make one comment, rather. Yes. What I've read, and this is striking to me, because it's a lament that almost makes you feel like he wants to bury himself in the past in the way that he does. But what little I've read of him is he tries to embrace and find the holiness and the religious side of the modern world.
Yes.
And reaches out in that direction instead of turning his back.
Well, there's no contradiction when it comes to the... It's an interesting point, but here we're talking about Shabbos. So Shabbos, you only want to go in one direction, toward more Shabbos and deeper Shabbos. But yes, clearly he did walk away from that world. So there's no question about that. But at least temporarily. There's a big debate as to what extent he was ultimately a philosopher. Many people who have great education in their youth, if they spend the bulk of their time on other things, like Rabbi Lichtenstein calls himself a renegade of Western culture, because when he went to Israel, he stopped teaching literature. And Rabbi Soloveitchik really never taught philosophy, particularly the course here or there. So there are those who say, no, Rabbi Wurzburg or other people who knew him well, they said, no, if you talk to him in his living room, he was always a philosopher. His students who saw him studying Talmud, they said, that was just a side thing. He did it when he was young, and he could, and he wanted to, and he did it, and he swallowed all that literature, and he read all those books. But it's not really what he's about. He's about the same thing every other rabbi's about, which is Talmud and all that. So it's a big debate. Let's
move.
Yes?
This, Ben, what you said, I remember, I'm the oldest one here, I think, I remember in the 50s, my dad was very involved in the southern region of Orthodox Jewry, and congregation after congregation was becoming conservative. They were having mixed seating, and the feeling at that time was really that this is the death of Orthodoxy in America. It was a very, for people who were involved in it was a very, very traumatic time, and I related to this, not that he was looking back, but he was just bemoaning what the future was going to hold if this is what's happening now.
Yes. Yes, although I think he could see the glimmer of hope in his students. He saw that he could train students and their minds to think the way he did, and they too would be teachers, but he was wondering whether their hearts would be as ablaze with the passion of about Torah like those who came before. But yes, I was thinking about your father. Aleph Shalom. Now, Vikashtem Yisham, that wonderful book in which started in this as an addendum to the Ish Halacha, the Halachic Man, and later came out a book of From There You Shall Seek, or something like that. So Rabbi Kefet takes a piece out from there, and indeed he does try to convey what learning Torah means to him. Because again, as an existentialist, it's all about expressing your feelings of what you experience in the here and now. So let's take a look. He says, I'm going to tell you what Mesorah is, what tradition is, tradition, and he's going to tell a personal story. He's going to tell you that as a child he had one friend, the Rambam, right? He was a constant guest in our home. So let's read from My Father Studied. Who would like to read that? Sheldon?
My father studied with his disciples in the room where my bed was located. My wont was to sit on my bed and listen to my father's words.
No, so it wasn't a big yeshiva. It was the yeshiva was his, I wouldn't call it a living room. It was the other room aside from the bedroom. Go ahead.
He constantly quoted Rambam. His method was to first open the Talmud and analyze the text under discussion in the relevant commentaries. He would generally say, these are the explanations of Tosafot, Talmudic commentary. Now let's analyze the explanations of Rambam.
Rambam is Maimonides, the great rabbi from the Middle Ages. Go on.
My father would inevitably discover that Rambam rejected the basic explanation of the text and differed with Tosafot. My father would declare, as if to complain, that we cannot comprehend the approach and conclusion of Rambam of course, the Talmudic text. It was almost as if my father were directly saying to Rambam, Rabbi Moshe, why have you taken this approach? My father would continue, at first glance, the Ravad, a commentary on the Rambam, is correct in his criticism. The students would jump forward and each would express his thoughts. My father would carefully listen, but would refute their proposed interpretations. Once again, he would exclaim that the words of Rambam were incomprehensible. Nevertheless, my father would not give up. He would place his head on his hand and soon be engrossed in deep thought. The students would not disturb his thought process. Finally, my father would gradually lift his head and begin to expound the true meaning of Rambam. Sometimes he would be lengthy, and on other occasions, brief. I would strain my ears to catch my father's every word. My young and impressionable mind to develop the dual impression. First, that the Rambam was being attacked by enemies who wanted to hurt him, and second, that the Rambam's only defender was my father. I felt strongly that without my father, who knows what would happen to the Rambam? It was as if the Rambam himself were with us in the room, listening to my father's words. The Rambam sat next to me on my bed. What did he look like? I don't know exactly. He seemed to look like an exceedingly handsome and good father. His name was also Moshe, just like my father. Intensely following my father, the students absorbed his every word. Slowly but surely, the tension evaporated. My father continued his discourse with strength and courage. New ideas were clarified. The laws under discussion were classified, and carefully articulated. A new light emerged. The questions were resolved and the topic properly explained. Rambam emerged triumphant, and my father's face was filled with happiness and delight. He had defended his friend, Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon. The Rambam was comforted and smiled. I, too, was delighted, enjoying the feeling of joining the room. I would jump from my bed and run to my mother and cry out the good news. Mother, mother, the Rambam won. He beat the Ravad. Father helped him. Look how wonderful my father is. Once in a great while, my father did not succeed. And despite all his efforts, the enemies of the Rambam defeated him. Their questions were as strong as iron. Although my father mustered all his strength, he could not save the Rambam from his detractors. Salvation did not come from the Rambam, for the Rambam. Deep in thought, my father would lean his head on his palms with his hands on the table. The students and I, and even the Rambam, waited in great tension for my father's words. And my father would raise his head and sadly state, "There is no answer. The words of the Rambam are difficult." The shiur ended with no explanation. The students were sad, and even my father was depressed. A sense of despair descended upon all of us. I cried. Even the eyes of the Rambam glistened with teardrops.
So, wow. In another version of this story, he turns to his mother and says, "What are we going to do? The Rambam is in trouble." So she says, "Don't worry, don't worry. Your father will find an answer. And if he doesn't find an answer, then you'll find the answer when you grow up." So, this also reminds me of my class with Rabbi Soloveitchik. I did not attend a typical class with Rabbi Soloveitchik because I was in there for the last 2.5 years where he was suffering from Parkinson's and other kinds of things. But it was very similar to this in that I would actually have the privilege of reading the Rambam, and then we read another passage, and then there was a contradiction. And then there was a problem. He would sit and he would think. And we'd all sit around and we'd look at different commentators. Sometimes one of the students would try to raise a solution. He didn't like it. And one classic thing that happened was Rabbi Ganak, the head of Kashrut at the OU, would sometimes pop in if he happened to be at YU, and sit in the class. Rabbi Soloveitchik was stuck and he couldn't figure it out. And Rabbi Ganak stood up and he gave a 10-minute lecture about what Rabbi Soloveitchik had said 35 years ago and how a beautiful solution had been proposed. So Rabbi Soloveitchik listened very respectfully. He liked the rabbi, a big student of his. He said, "That's very nice. That's what I said then. But what do I say today?" And moving along. Now, we move to the next paragraph where he talks about, really describes himself. He describes himself, and again, I can relate to this very much in terms of Rabbi Soloveitchik, because I attended his class when he was over 80 years old, and I was 20 years old. And there should have been this great generation gap. Don't forget, this was not too long after the 70s, where the big thing was the generation gap, because the new generation had all these new ideas, and there was a big generation gap. And Rabbi Soloveitchik describes bridging the generation gap, both here and in the next paragraph, And it also describes the Masorah. How does the tradition work? How are you supposed to convey from one generation to the other? You have a generation gap. If you have a generation gap, how can you have transmission of the tradition? So it's not going to work. Who would like to read that? Debbie?
The old Rebbe, is that which one?
Yes.
The old Rebbe walks into the classroom crowded with students who are young enough to be his grandchildren. He enters as an old man with wrinkled face, his eyes reflecting the fatigue and sadness of old age. You have to be old to experience the sadness. It is the melancholy that results from an awareness of people and things which have disappeared and linger only in memory. I sit down. Opposite me are rows of young, beaming faces with clear eyes radiating the joy of being young. For a moment, the Rebbe is gripped with pessimism, with tremors of uncertainty. He asks himself, can there be a dialogue between an old teacher and young students, between a Rebbe in his Indian summer and students enjoying the spring of their lives? The Rebbe starts his shiur, uncertain as to how it will proceed.
Rabbi Salvation is describing the process in general of an old Rebbe relating to his students, but we all know that he's talking about himself.
Okay.
Suddenly the door opens and an old man, much older than the Rebbe, enters. He is the grandfather of the Rebbe, Rabbi Chaim Brisker.
That's his grandfather.
Pardon?
That's his grandfather.
It would be most difficult to study Talmud with students who are trained in the sciences and mathematics, were it not for his method, which is very modern and equals, if not surpasses, most contemporary forms of logic, metaphysics, or philosophy.
This is his claim that his grandfather's thinking was not just good Talmud, but it was so sophisticated that it was a perfect thing to teach young minds and young students because it was so scientific. This is in a world where science was very important. Recently, science is taking a backseat to spirituality and all kinds of other things. But in that era, he thought that was very key. And I heard from many students of his that, you know, I was going off the path, but when I went into his class, I said, well, you know, if Torah is this brilliant, well, you know, where do I sign up? Go ahead.
The door opens again and another old man comes in. He is older than Reb Chaim, for he lived in the 17th century. His name is Reb Shabtai Cohen, known as the Shach, who must be present when civil law, Dinai Mamonot, is discussed. Many more visitors arrive, some from the 11th, 12th, and 13th centuries, and others harking back to antiquity, Rabbeinu Tam, Rashi, Rambam, Rabbi, Rashbam, Rabbi Akiva, and others. These scholarly giants of the past are bidden to take their seats. The Rebbe introduces the guests to his pupils, and the dialogue commences. The Rambam starts a halakha. The Rabbi disagrees sharply, as is his wont. Some students interrupt to defend the Rambam, and they express themselves harshly against the Rabbi, as young people are apt to do. The Rebbe softly corrects the students and suggests more restrained tones. The Rashbah smiles gently. The Rebbe tries to analyze what the students meant, and other students intercede. Rabbeinu Tam is called upon to express his opinion, and suddenly a symposium of generations comes into existence. Young students debate earlier generations with an air of daring familiarity, and a crescendo of discussion ensues. All speak one language, all pursue one goal. All are committed to a common vision, and all operate with the same categories. A Masorah collegiality is achieved, a friendship, a comradeship of old and young, spanning antiquity, the Middle Ages, and modern times. This joining of the generations, this march of centuries, this dialogue and conversation between antiquity and the present will finally bring about the redemption of the Jewish people. After a 2 or 3 hour shiur,
that's a class,
from the chamber, young and rejuvenated. He has defeated age. The students look exhausted. In the Masorah experience, years play no role. Hands, however parchment, dry and wrinkled, embrace warm and supple hands in commonality, bridging the gap which separates the generations. Thus, the old ones of the past continue their great dialogue with the generations, ensuring an enduring commitment to the Masorah.
So it's interesting how it dovetails the previous passage. Right here, he was listening as a child, listening to his father's class, and here he's describing his own class, and it's a symposium of the generations. This image of a man who's too old to give a class, trying to relate to the students, again, I relate to on a personal level, because when I had him, he had Parkinson's, and when he walked in, he was very stiff, and he couldn't look like he couldn't move, and he couldn't think, and he couldn't see, and he couldn't hear. And by the end of the class, he woke up, and we felt like we had provided them the best therapy session that you could imagine. and that he knocked off, you know, 15 years just by giving the class. Second thing was when I was in his class, he told us that someone had asked him if he would give a talk at a symposium about the commemorating the 800 years since the Maimonides' passing. I think it was 800, to do the math. And he said, one problem, I didn't know he died. So this relates very much to this passage. In the next section, again from the Reflections of the Rav, Part 2, Rabbi Bezdin's summation of some of his writings, he also talks about the Masorah relationship of a father to a grandchild. It contains emotional intensity and intellectual closeness. Now, as usually we think of a grandfather as a nice, fuzzy guy that you pat on the back, but here, and you give him a kiss. But here he says also intellectual closeness. The child represents the hopes for spiritual continuity. They do not have to confront each other as cultural antagonists. They can share a Masorah that bridges the gap. And then he quotes a statement here from Adiot, from a Mishnah, second to last paragraph on the left on page 16. He says, Rabbi Akiva says, a father endows his son with comely appearance, or whatever appearance he has, strength, riches, or such as they are, wisdom, longevity, and mispar hadoro lefanav, the number of generations that have been before him. And that's the secret. So what does that mean? So what does that mean? That's the secret. How do you convey the generations before? So he says, no, that's what he's talking about. A parent transmits the generations that came before to the child. That's the Masorah. And that's the solution. That will help bring the eschatological fulfillment of the end of days, the redemption of the Jewish people, if we continue to intellectually and emotionally transmit to our children the secret of our past generations. And therefore he says that the first father in the Torah who spoke to his grandchild was Yaakov, and that's why Yaakov is a special forefather. We're called sons of Israel, children of Israel, because there's no difference between Israel and us, because Israel was able to speak to his grandchildren. He gave them a blessing. And when you're able to cross the generation gap, the generational divide, then you've gotten to that secret of the Masorah, of the transmission, and that's what Israel is. Moving on to the reflections of the Rav, how do you express the idea of, we talked about the idea of learning. What is learning? Learning is a symposium of generations. What is tradition? It means to bridge the generation gap and to be able to have a symposium and a discussion across generations. Excuse me. What is Kedusha? If we ask ourselves, we say, well, Shabbos is holy. What does that mean? Israel is holy. He was a big Zionist. He said, I'm sorry, my family was against Zionism. I'm a Zionist. I can't help it. I love Israel. And he hears God knocking at the door, his famous lecture about that God's knocking at the door using the words of Song of Songs. He knocked at the door, he gave us a state, he gave the UN approved in a strange, bizarre situation. The UN gave us Israel. And he says, even the Soviet Union and the United States agreed for 5 minutes that there should be an Israel. He says, this is, God is knocking, something special is happening. So how do you convey what is Kedusha, what's special about the land of Israel? So he says there's something called Segula. The Jewish people were told that they're going to be an Am Segula. We usually say it translates as a treasured nation. But he also wants to use Segula as something singular, exceptional, extraordinary. He says Segula, there could be Segula relationships, like the bond of Rachel and Jacob. It was a singular bond, or Jacob's relationship with Benjamin. His soul was bound up with the lad's soul. He said the people of Israel are a Segula people, singularly valued by God. This involves no denigration of other nations. It's a specialness, a nation of one of its kind, which God has designated to preserve and disseminate His divine teachings. This is singularity. who wants to read the singular land of Israel? Okay, Steve?
The Segula people inhabits a Segula land. It is a land which the Eternal your God looks after, on which the Lord your God always keeps his eye from year's beginning to year's end. Rashi adds that although God cares for other lands too, his relationship with Eretz Yisrael is special. The Midrash elaborates. Reb Shimon ben Yochai expounded the verse
in Habakkuk.
He rose and measured the land, as meaning God measured, assessed all lands, but found none suitable for Israel except Eretz Yisrael. Jewish destiny is linked with this land. We have no other. Only in this land, our sages say, does the Shekhinah dwell, and only therein does prophecy flourish. This segula attribute of the land is no more rationally explicable than the segula of the people. These are qualities certified by our faith, and history has corroborated the singularity of both people and land.
Now, these words are not exactly his words. Rabbi Bezdin sort of doctored it up so it would be more readable. But nonetheless, you see him struggling and trying to convey what is Kedusha, what is holiness, separateness, chosenness, and what is our special connection to the land of Israel. And he elaborates on that theme in many other places as well. Now, the next passage, which is found in Family Redeemed, a collection of essays that talk about importance of family. Those of you who are interested in psychology or family might find it interesting. And here he talks about the relationship of the external and the internal. One of the Rabbi Soloveitchik's big themes, especially as a philosopher and a legal scholar, so you have philosophy, that's what, you know, the sort of the inner world of the Jewish life. And then there's the halacha, that seems to be the outer world, that's like, what do? The Jewish law. So the relationship between the two, something that he was interested in, and I'd like to explore that in the next number of writings. So if we look here, he says, we're reading the underlined phrases in the paragraph objectivity and subjectivity. I thank Rabbi J.J. Schachter for his underlining. The religious gesture must be objectified and crystallized in concrete physical deeds. In other words, you might say, well, I'm very religious. I have a feeling about God. You got to concretize it. You got to concretize it. Moving along, he says, behavioral patterns are always accompanied by corresponding worthy emotions. Right? So whatever you're doing, you often have emotions to go with it. Feelings not manifesting themselves in deeds, if you don't do it, you just feel it, it's volatile, transient, goes away. Deeds not linked with inner experience are soulless and ritualistic. So on the one hand, if it just has a deed and no inner experience, what's the point? Has no soul. But on the other hand, if you just have a feeling and there's no deed, then it's volatile. Today it's here, it's gone tomorrow. Man, he says, halacha has been teaching us, must first of all respond to the call of duty and act in according with divine discipline. So there's, in halacha, in Judaism, we ask, people are called on for duty, for responsibility, for mitzvah, and you act in accordance with divine discipline. Judaism is first discipline and second the romance. So interesting, the relationship between the two. You often explore, sort of, let's take mourning, for instance. He did a lot of work on mourning. Let's see, so someone's mourning, so they're sitting shiva, they're sitting on a low stool, and they take off their shoes. That's the external expressions. And the inner experience is the mourning itself. So there's the maaseh mitzvah, there's the action of the mitzvah, and there's the fulfillment. Sometimes the action and fulfillment are the same thing. Let's say you honor your parents. The goal is to honor your parents. The action is honoring your parents, and the fulfillment and the action are the same thing. Okay, it's hard to conceive how you could separate it. But sometimes it's different. For instance, you ask God so that your dog shouldn't die. Okay? So that's the outer experience. The inner experience is you're worshiping God in your heart. So Rabbi Soloveitchik did a lot of work on the outer and the inner. Speaking of one of the major themes of the inner world of the Torah is the importance of life, the affirmation of life. And this relates to that last point, that Judaism is more about this world than it is the next. And Judaism is more about actual concrete things than it is the metaphysical. In other words, there are mystics, and then there are people like Rabbi Soloveitchik. Rabbi Soloveitchik believes that we can get to a very high place just through the practice, that if it's heartfelt and it's connected to the fulfillment, not only the action. And we can get to high places. We don't have to go into the realm of the mystical. So listen to what he writes in Halachic Man, where he tries to describe the philosophy of his grandfather, the Briskers. And so he says, the earth, the second line on page 34, the earth and bodily life are the very ground of the halachic reality. Are you with me? Page 34, Halachic Man. Okay. Second line. The earth and bodily life are the very ground of the halachic reality. In other words, the halacha, if you want to focus not on mysticism or something like that, but you want to focus on the bread and butter of Judaism, the Jewish law, which Rabbi Soloveitchik taught for years and years and years, he says, then the main thing is the earth and the body. That's the ground, that's the basic starting point of the halachic reality. We want to know, did the sun go down or didn't it go down? Right? In terms of time, did I slaughter the animal or didn't I? Did I cut most of the throat or most of the trachea and the esophagus or didn't I? It's a physical question, right? Does this animal have certain physical blemishes or doesn't? These are physical, earthy questions which bother the mind of halachic Jews all the time, right? Next paragraph. So he says, so he talks about the importance of life, and we'll get back to the point, to the inner and the outer. So he says, for instance, the saving of life overrides the commandments of the entire Torah. We know that, right? And it's forbidden to delay such violation. And he says on page 35, that on third line, my grandfather, Reb Chaim Abris, disagree with the legal view that on the Day of Atonement, one feeds a sick person who is in danger small amounts of food at a time, each amount less than a forbidden measure. Rather, he instructed those who were taking care of the sick individual to serve him a regular meal, just as they would on other days. When my father was about to travel to Razin, a town close to Kovna, to take up a rabbinical post, then Reb Chaim, the grandfather, took his father aside and said, I command you to follow my view regarding a sick person in danger on the Day of Atonement, for it's an absolute halachic truth. So in other words, a person who's truly imbued with the spirit of Judaism will understand that life comes first. And therefore, while there are some opinions that what we should do is, if you need to eat on Yom Kippur, you should just eat a little bit at a time, so that way there's no technical violation. And there are many authorities do say that if it doesn't hurt your health. He says, no, we have to take a very proactive view on health, that if you're allowed to eat, then just eat to your heart's desire. Don't take small amounts. Or, for instance, if you, let's say, someone is sick in the family, then you need to call the doctor. So you might say, well, I'm not going to use this phone. I'll go outside. There's a Gentile outside. I'll ask him to use the phone. He would, in the olden days before political correctness, if his son said that, he would smack him across the face and say, what? We don't do that. You do it yourself. This is the Rambam's view that the rabbi should violate Shabbos, not the goy, not the Gentile, not the kid, because in order to save a life, you should take a very proactive view. Which leads to a different point on the next paragraph from the bottom of 35. We have stated that Judaism has a negative attitude toward death. This is a very strange view. Yitz Greenberg, I think, taking off on this point, he believes like the whole Torah is about life. The Beit HaMikdash, says Yitz Greenberg, which is the center of Jewish life, there's no contact with death. Nobody there has had contact with death for 7 days. The Kohen Gadol, the high priest, hasn't been to a funeral in like 20 years, right? All the Kohenim don't go to funerals that they don't have to. So he says, indeed, many Rishonim, third line from the bottom, exempted the high priest from all rites of mourning. He wouldn't even sit Shiva. Holiness is rooted and embedded in joy, not in this type of stuff. A death and holiness are contradictory, right? Many churches have the holy ones buried underneath the church. That's anathema to us, right? Death and holiness are contradictory. Reb Chaim, the Gaon of Vilna and Rabbi Yosef Dov Salvejik, his namesake, his great grandfather, his son Reb Chaim, and his grandson Reb Moshe of Feinstein, one of the early Feinsteins, never visited cemeteries and never prostrated themselves on the graves of their ancestors. In other words, many Jews like to visit a cemetery once a year, after the Shloshim, different. So no, they never went to the cemetery. They would go for the funeral, but that's it. Never visit a grave. Rabbi Salvejik had a weak point on this. He was so devastated by the death of his wife and was so attached to, probably his one real friend, that he used to go there every week to his wife's grave. But the family tradition, you don't go at all. And therefore there's a fear of death. Reb Chaim would sometimes reflect on death, because the beauty and splendor of this world in contrast with the fate of man creates a great mystery. He says, so in any event, it's interesting, this idea of Judaism as being anti-death. Interesting concept. Moving along to page 38, in the relationship of Rabbi Salvejik to the physical world. So there's a famous story on page 38 in the middle. Is it underlined there? Yes, where it's underlined. It says, I remember how once, on the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, I went outside into the synagogue courtyard with my father, Rabbi Moshe Salvejik, just before the Ne'ilah, the final service. It had been a fresh, clear day, one of the fine, almost delicate days of summer's end, filled with sunshine and light. Evening was fast approaching, and an exquisite autumn sun was sinking in the west. Beyond the trees of the cemetery, it was a sea of purple and gold. Rabbi Moses, halachic man par excellence, turned to me and said, this sunset differs from ordinary sunsets, for with it forgiveness is bestowed upon us for our sins. Based on the concept that the end of the day of Yom Kippur is really the part that atones. The Day of Atonement and the forgiveness of sins merge and blended here with the splendor and the beauty of the world, with the hidden lawfulness of the order of creation, and the whole was transformed into one living, holy, cosmic phenomenon. So a sunset wasn't a sunset. It was a sunset, and it was also a halachic expression. Told in another way, it was like, forget the sunset. This is Yom Kippur here. It's happening, right? The atonement is happening. But told this way, you can blend the two together.
But he does mention that he could see the cemetery. He sort of incorporates
that. Oh, interesting. Interesting. And if you turn to the next page, where there's a bracket, it says, the halachic person, they don't concern themselves with transcendence, right? We're not these mystics interested in, we're going to go off in another world, close our eyes and go off somewhere else, with questions that are above space and time, but with problems of earthly life and its details and particulars. Rabbis have to be, Rashi had to be an expert in, how do you make wine? Because you need to understand what's considered Gentile wine and Jewish wine. How does a wheel work? How does a weaver weave? So we can understand what you can do on Shabbos and not do on Shabbos. They're experts in these things. So he says, the homo religiosus, the religious persona, proclaims the lower yearns for the higher. And as most religious people say, the lower things, they're so bad, we're waiting all of our life for the higher stuff. But the halachic man, the unique Jewish religious experience, with its unique mode of understanding, declares the higher longs and pines for the lower. The God says, show me a good, kishka. The old joke was that a student had studied the laws of what makes an animal not kosher. So sometimes there's a hole in the kurkuvan, one of the parts of the stomach. So so one time the student, he sees, he didn't know what a kurkuman was, but he studied, there was an organ and it had a hole in it. And so one time there was a lady that took out the kurkuman, and she took it and the student said, it's the holy kurkuman, it's the holy intestine of some, because these are the physical things, they're significant in as much as they're topics of halachic Jewish legal discussions. Okay. His further complaints about subjectification, about the idea of everything just being sort of mushy, just mystical kind of stuff, or just kind of mushy, as opposed to more objective, less scientific. He wants religion to be more scientific, but also to have a soul. So it's both. In Halachic Man, he talks about objectification. No, I'm not Halachic Man. This is Halachic Mind. Sorry, it's an Halachic Mind. Sorry, misprint. Objectification. Who'd like to read that? Want to try that? No, now we're on this page. It only has one side. There you go. Yes.
Yes. Which is his highest expression in the halacha. Halacha is an act of preventing legal good. So derided by theologians is nothing but an exact method of objectification.
So you're right. You think that legalism, oh, we're so silly. Is it? Did he slaughter this part of the trachea or not? Is a sukkah? Is it this tall? Is it that tall? And you can make fun of it, and you can poke fun at the rabbis. He said, "What are you talking about? This is like a scientific taking. We're taking the subjective human religious experience, and we're objectifying into a sukkah and a shofar and a neck and a kishka." So. It's scientific. It's not something to make fun of. Go ahead.
The modes of our response to what supremely impresses us. It's interesting to note that the halakha frequently operates with quantitative standards.
We say you have to have this much wine and this much bread and this much this. Go ahead.
It attempts not only to objectify religiosity, but also to quantify it. Accurate measurement is a cardinal principle of halakha. And the religious experience is often and mathematically determined. Reminiscent of Galileo's dictum, the book of Halacha is replete with triangles, circles, and squares. Hence, the reconstruction of objective aspects within the objective Halachic order is far more complicated than that of the ordinary religious act. There's enormous distance between Halachic objectivity and its subjective
count. Right, so he wants to dignify halacha, make it into something more scientific. He wants to dignify the religious experience that there's an experience that we have to explain to others what is halacha. So before we talk about what's tradition, now we want to understand what is this business with halacha? You spend your whole life, is it like this, like that, is it 4 feet, 4.5 feet, how many amos, how many hand breaths, and how many fingers? What is this all about? He said, what do you mean? We're trying to put the emotional subjective experience, which is fleeting, and it's volatile, and who knows what happens to it, and, you know, in its extreme form, you'll find yourself, you know, dancing who knows how in the forest, you know, with the moon or something, but instead it objectifies it and it concretizes it and it gives it form and it's scientific and you can quantify it. So exciting. So this is trying to express a unique a Jewish experience in a language for the modern person.
Can't be done.
That's a question, right? And right before we started off by saying, well, you can't tell anybody what Erev Shabbos is. You got to be there in Europe and watch everyone go crazy about Erev Shabbos. And throughout our readings here, we're seeing he's trying to describe the religious experience. Now, prayer. So again, he in many cases you find there's a lot of sort of in people who are trying to justify Judaism or what do they call that, apologetics of sorts. But and in that era, there was a lot of that. If you read the Hertz Chumash, for instance, from 100 years ago, they're always trying to justify, you know, Jewish things. And there's a certain element of that here. But it's also trying to be a spokesperson for the what's uniquely Jewish. You might say, Christian prayer, Jewish prayer, Muslim prayer, Buddhist prayer. It's all the same thing. What's unique about Jewish prayer? So look what he says over here. Judaism is, who wants to read that? Number two. Where it says tradition, redemption, prayer, and Talmud Torah. Okay.
Judaism in helpful distinction to mystical Quietism, which recommended toleration of pain, wants man to cry out loud against any kind of pain, to react indignantly to all kinds of injustice or unfairness. For Judaism held that the individual who displays indifference to pain and suffering, who meekly reconciles himself to the ugly, disproportionate, and unjust in life, is not capable of appreciating human goodness. Whoever permits his legitimate needs to go unsatisfied will never be sympathetic to the crying needs of others. A human morality based on love and friendship, on sharing the travail of others, cannot be practiced if the person's own need awareness is dull and he does not know what suffering is. Instudious and rejected models of existence which deny human need, such as the angelic or the monastic. For Judaism, need awareness constitutes part of the definition of human existence. Need awareness turns into a passional experience, into a suffering awareness. I suffer, therefore I am, to paraphrase Descartes, could be to Emerson. While the Cartesian cogito would also apply to an angel or even to the devil, our inference is limited to man. Neither angel nor devil knows suffering. Therefore, prayer in Judaism, unlike the prayer of classical mysticism, is bound up with human needs, wants, strives, and urges which make man suffer. Prayer is the doctrine of human needs. Prayer tells the individual as well as the community what his or its genuine needs are and what he should or should not petition God about. The 19 benedictions in our Amida, 13 are concerned with basic human needs, individual as well as social, national.
Okay, so et cetera, et cetera. So now, by the way, this is in total contrast to Hasidic view, which says that, no, don't pray for your needs. That's so lowly of you. Pray for the needs of God. You see, I need for my stock to go up, but that's not because for me. I need it to go up because I need it for so that I can worship God more. So it's really God's needs. So remember last week we talked about Heschel, man in search of God, God in search of man. That's based on a mystical idea. But he says, nonsense. If prayer, you ask for things, you ask for things. That's what it's all about. Now, it tells us to ask, you know, for the whole community. Don't only think of yourself. But if you don't understand your needs, don't get up and pray. The permission that Rabbi Salvation talks about, in order to do certain things, you need a permit. So the permit to get up and pray, he said, well, what do you want? You know, God, I'm here. What would you like? Nothing. Get out of here. You have to need something. So it's the whole essence of prayer is about what you need, and yet, you know, ascetics would say, "What do you mean? I don't need anything. I don't want anything. I don't need." So there is an ascetic strand in Judaism, but he says that's not the main strand. The main strand says, "Fine, your needs are very legitimate. We affirm them in our prayers." So here he tries to convey what is unique about Jewish prayer. And again, it's very earthy, like the halachic man, who's very down to earth. Then we spoke last time, and again, this may relate to the idea of the relationship of Torah, not only to the ethereal things, but also to the mundane. We're talking about modernity. We read last week, we were talking about Heschel, and he was sort of blasting everyone for being so, you know, pursuing success and stuff like that, and, you know, where's God, and things like that. But Rabbi Salvation, you feel much more accommodation with the pursuit of success. And let's take a little look at some of that. Lowly Man of Faith. In The Lowly Man of Faith, he talks about Adam 1, Adam 2, the typology, he likes typologies. Typology of man who is a scientist, typology of man who's more of a religious persona, and the need to sort of combine the two. So look over here how he describes the advantage, the religious, ethical, religious, moral advantage of modernity. And science. Who would like to read page 16? Ben, did you have a chance? Nancy, do you want to? Okay. Did you read it?
Pardon?
Did you have a chance yet?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. We'll give Nancy a chance.
The brute's existence is an undignified one because it is a helpless existence. Human existence is a dignified one because it is a glorious, majestic, powerful existence. Hence, dignity is unobtainable as long as man has not reclaimed himself in coexistence with nature and has not risen from a non-reflective, degradingly helpless, instinctive life to an intelligent, planned, and majestic one. For the sake of clarification of the double equation, humanity equals dignity and dignity equals glory, majesty, it is necessary to add another thought. There is no dignity without responsibility. And one cannot assume responsibility as long as he is not capable of living up to his commitments. Only when man rises to the heights of freedom, of action, and creativity of mind does he begin to implement the mandate of dignified responsibility entrusted to him by his maker.
Go on to the next paragraph, man of old.
Man of old, who could not fight disease and succumbed in multitudes to yellow fever or any other plague with degrading helplessness, could not lay claim to dignity.
You know, in 1879, Bethel Emeth congregation died because everybody died from the yellow fever. Go on.
Only the man who builds hospitals, discovers therapeutic techniques, and saves lives is blessed with dignity. Man of the 17th and 18th centuries, who needed several days to travel from Boston to New York, was less dignified than modern man who attempts to conquer space, boards a plane at the New York airport at midnight, and takes several hours later a leisurely walk along the streets of London.
By the way, the rabbi commuted to Boston every week. Go on.
The brute is helpless and therefore not dignified. Civilized man has gained limited control of nature and has become, in certain respects, her master. And with his mastery, he has attained dignity as well. His mastery has made it possible for him to act in accordance with his responsibility.
Right. So here he seems to embrace this as a mandate of man. Now, it's not the only mandate. We have another mandate we'll talk about in the next page. But one of the mandates is to attain greater dignity. And in that sense, it's a big deal that that somebody figured out how to, for me to travel without sweating from Boston to New York. Right? But right, some religious thinkers might think, so what? You think you're a big shot because you can pick up your cell phone, you can call your mother in Florida? You know, it's... So what? You know, is that really so? So you could see how, you know, different thinkers would think different ways. He kind of embraces modern achievements and technology in that way. But he says it's not the only mandate of man. Go ahead, page 18. Ben, you want to continue for us on 18?
Hence, Adam the first is aggressive, bold, and victory-minded.
That's the person we described in the previous page.
His motto is success, triumph over the cosmic forces. Engages in creative work, trying to imitate his maker.
Right. It's et cetera. Right. And in the second page, on page 19, in doing all this, Adam the first is trying to carry out the mandate entrusted to him by his maker. With the dawn of the six mysterious days of creation, addressed himself and said, fill the earth and subdue it. Right? So that's what man does. It expresses his freedom. But Ben, read for us on page 22, number 3.
I made that comment earlier. He's looking to...
Right.
This and finding what's important and dignified about it, as opposed to saying, no, I'm not going to work, I'm going to study.
Right. Right. He gives complete... in many ways, the Lonely Man of Faith somehow is like a manifesto of modern orthodoxy, of the idea of working and contributing to the world and also... being a religious persona, but we have to do both parts. Let's take a look on page 22, Adam the second, where it says Adam the second.
In order to answer this triple question, Adam, is that down here?
No. Page 22, Adam the second.
Where?
Oh, next page. You have to turn the page. Let me see.
Okay. Here it is. Adam the second keeps on wondering, who is he who trails me steadily, uninvited and unwanted, like an everlasting shadow, and vanishes into the recesses of transcendence the very instant I turn around to confront this numinous,
mysterious
being.
Right?
Who is he who fills Adam with awe and bliss, humility, and a sense of greatness concurrently? Who is he who to whom Adam clings in passionate, all-consuming love, and from whom he flees in mortal fear and dread? Who is he who fascinates Adam irresistibly, and at the same time rejects him irrevocably? Who is he who Adam experiences both as the mysterium tremendum and as the most elementary, most obvious, and most understandable truth? Who is he who is duus revelatus and duus absconditus simultaneously?
Right, so I guess the deity who's revealed and the deity who absconds, who was hidden. Go ahead.
Who is he whose life-giving and life-warming breath Adam feels constantly, and who at the same time remains distant and remote from all? In order to answer this triple question, Adam II does not apply the functional method invented by Adam I. He does not create a world of his own. Instead, he wants to understand the living, given world into which he has been cast.
Right. So, go ahead.
Therefore, he does not mathematize phenomena or conceptualize things. He encounters the universe in all its colorfulness, splendor, and grandeur, and studies it with the naivete, awe, and admiration of the child who seeks the unusual and wonderful in every ordinary thing and event.
Right. So in Halachic Man, he takes this idea of the sort of scientist, who's Adam 1, who's described in chapter 1 of Genesis, versus chapter 2 of Genesis, Adam 2, who's more of the religious persona, and he describes the halachic man, who's a combination of both, who also, on the one hand, the halachic man is like Adam 1. He's not inventing a new way to get to Boston, but he may be thinking of a new way of understanding the Rambam. And he's not this religious persona who just sits back and just in awe of the mysterium tremendum, but he also he tries to conceptualize things. He encounters the world as it is, as we said before, the physical world. He's not trying to go off in the other hemispheres, and he studies it with awe. And but he might also, let's see, yeah. Here he says that Adam too would not want to conceptualize. But a halachic man is always conceptualizing. So the halachic man does a little bit of both. All right, let us continue. Yes?
If we talk about what does the lonely part signify?
Later on he talks about the... I'm more of an expert at the beginning of the book. I think later on he talks about the loneliness. The man from within his lonely experience calls out to God. And in God's uniqueness and his loneliness, man, he reaches out to man. Yeah, I frankly, I have a terrible admission to make. I don't understand the whole picture of lonely man of faith. Yeah. In the end, he talks about prayer, but it's something about that. He claims that one of the fundamental human experiences is that we're lonely. He doesn't mean that we don't have friends. It means that even if we have friends and spouses and all kinds of things, there's a certain uniqueness to our soul that we can't traverse it to connect with anyone else. We have to call out to God in that loneliness, and that's where we find God. So he writes a lot about that in different places. So in other articles, he tried to play with this idea of majesty and humility. The humble man who just looks at the world and says, wow, or the mad, majestic man who says, So he has a wonderful expression here. Picture someone in the 70s or in the late 60s when they were landing on the moon to be able to describe cosmic man. That man is cosmic, right? So again, this is trying to take a modern term because people are thinking about the cosmos and they're going off to the moon. And he's trying to describe Judaism in the language of the cosmic. Okay? So let's take a look on page 27. It's an article called Majesty and Humility, where he contrasts two aspects of man that, on the one hand, we're from dust, but on the other hand, if you look on the top, Rashi says God gathered the dust from the entire earth, from its four corners. So man is cosmic. Our dust that we come from comes from all the different parts of the world. Or if you want to think of it scientifically, you know, what is that called? The table of
periodic
table of all the elements, right? All the elements that comprise us. These are elements that are found in everything out there, especially in the organic world. So, in any event, let's see three ways in which man is cosmic. Who would like to? Let's see. Let me just summarize that. On page 27 there, Majesty and Humility, he's first, man is cosmic through his intellectual involvement. His intellectual curiosity is of cosmic universal dimensions. In other words, person doesn't care. So you say, why is this guy studying zoology? Why is he studying about the African tsetse fly? Why is this fellow studying studying the history or the music or the art of some culture that's so foreign. Why are we interested in going to Mars? Or why, right? And the answer is that our curiosity is cosmic. The human curiosity is absolutely cosmic. Man is restless because he has not yet resolved the mysterium magnum of the cosmic drama. Okay. So remoteness magnifies rather than diminishes our curiosity. Okay. So that's that. Number two. Second, next paragraph. Man is cosmic through his experiential involvement. He loves the cosmos. He, in person, wants to be everywhere. This idea of man wants to be everywhere. He's questing not only to know the universe, he wants to experience it. He's an explorer. He's an adventurer. Excuse me. He feels bored with the monotony of the routine of the familiar. He wants to see the world. He's not satisfied sending up unmanned vehicles. Right? He's eager to do it himself. Right? He's very excited about space travel. Third, man is cosmic through his mobility. Because he says, is man like a tree? He says, no, absolutely not. Man is not like a tree. A tree stands still. Man does not. It's a cute little interpretation here. Man's greatness and distinctiveness find expression in his ceaseless mobility. So even this cosmic quest that we have, it's part of the human dignity. It's part of the human persona. And he's very much, you know, sort of justifying this this sort of idea. Now, one of the themes Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote about in a lot of places I thought I would touch on is also community, prayer, community. The idea that we're covenantal man, that the human being is a covenant with God. We have the universal covenant, also the Jewish covenant, the Sinai covenant. Every person has both our universal covenant and the Sinai covenant. And that community is very important. And somewhere there at the end of the halach, of the Lonely Man of Faith, he also speaks a lot about community. But in any event, it's interesting here how he picks on Job. He picks on Job on from Lonely Man of Faith. He has an interpretation of Job. You know, we always wonder, why did Job have so much suffering? So usually we say, we don't know. Only God knows. But actually, he decides to pick on him and say, what was wrong with Job? So who wants to read that for us? Let's see. The fenced-in egocentric. How about that? Third line.
The fenced-in egocentric and ego-oriented Adam the First is ineligible to join the covenantal prayer community of which God is a fellow member.
So you see him bringing together a lot of the themes toward the end of The Lonely Man of Faith. If you're just Adam 1, then you're not part of a covenantal community. You're not in relationship. You may need another person to be a partner to build a tower, but there's no relationship. In the Adam 2, more spiritual man, he is in more of a relationship with others. Go ahead.
If God abandons his transcendental numinous solitude, he wills man to do likewise, to step out of his isolation and aloneness.
So you have that idea that we reach out to God through our loneliness. Go ahead.
Job did not understand this simple postulate. And it was so, when the days of their feasting were gone about, that Job sent and sanctified them and rose up early in the morning and offered burnt offerings according to the number of them all.
In other words, Job was worried that his children sinned, that they partied too much. So every day after they had a party, he would bring sacrifice for them.
He did pray. He did offer sacrifices, but only for his household. Job failed to understand the covenantal nature of the prayer community in which destinies are dovetailed, suffering or joy is shared, and prayers merge into one petition on behalf of all. As we all know, Job's sacrifices were not accepted, Job's prayers remained unheard, and Job, pragmatic Adam the First, met with catastrophe, and the whirlwind uprooted him and his household. Only then did he discover the great covenantal experience of being together, praying together and for one another. And the Lord turned the captivity of Job when he prayed for his friends. Also, the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. Not only was Job rewarded with a double measure of material goods, but he also attained a new dimension of existence, the covenantal one.
Yes. So then he claims
his
that
mistake was that at first he prayed only for his children and not for himself.
No, not for others beyond his own family.
Oh, God.
Right. He should be in covenant. Yeah. So he claims that in order for prayer to be meaningful, it has to be it has to have an ethical message as well. It has to be for others as well. That the main ethical imperative is to reach out to others, and that he, therefore he said the synagogue should, this is a little problem in our shul, synagogue should have windows because we can see outside. The religious experience is not disconnected from the outside. We don't create some phony environment and then and try to get into God that place. We have to be connected to the world outside. So, and finally, one of Rabbi Soloveitchik's greatest sort of political contributions, or lack thereof, was his idea about confrontation. He wrote a famous article called Confrontation, in which he challenged the idea of trying to get involved in the polemics of the Catholics changing the Vatican philosophies. If they want to do that on their own, that's wonderful. But he didn't want to get involved. He didn't want to have a confrontation of two faiths. He said that we, page 21, we are a totally independent faith community. We do not revolve in any satellite or orbit. We're not related to any other faith community as brethren, even though separated. People, right? He says on another page, he says, as a faith individuality, the community of the few is endowed with intrinsic worth, which must be viewed against its own meta-historical backdrop. That relating to the framework of other faith community. We're not in any kind of saying that we're somehow brethren in faith denies the uniqueness of the intrinsic worth of my faith. Any intimation, overt or covert, on page 23, on the part of the community, of the many, that's the Christians, that is expected of the community, the few, that's the Jews, that it shed its uniqueness and cease existing because it has fulfilled its mission by paving the way for the community of the many, must be rejected as undemocratic, contravening the very idea of religious freedom. So he felt that it was somehow dehumanizing to have a conversation with another community. You have to if you look in the middle of on page 21, in the middle of the paragraph, it starts "we." We are not ready for a meeting with another faith community in which we shall become an object of observation. We don't want to be the object. Oh, let's see how your religion judgment and evaluation. We don't want to be evaluated by another religion, even though the community of the many may then condescendingly display a sense of compassion. Community of the few and advise many not to harm them, persecute the few. It would be very nice of them. They'll say not to persecute us, but we don't want to do that. We don't want to be an object. Such an encounter would convert the personal Adam-Eve meeting, right? Adam and Eve meet each other as equals, as individuals, as humans, into a hostile confrontation between subject-knower and knowable object. If you know Buber, he's talking about it's an I-it relationship. You would be encountering the other person, not as an I-thou, as an actual human being, but as an I-it. We do not intend to play the part of the object encountered by a dominating man. That would be the Christian faith. Soliciting commiseration is incongruous with the character of a democratic confrontation. In a democratic confrontation, we meet as free, separate individuals, not as its. There should rather be insistence upon one's inalienable rights as a human being created by God. In other words, to sit across the table from a Christian and say, you put out your cards, I'll put out my cards, let's evaluate each other's religion and we'll reform each other, is a dehumanizing experience because each one is looking at the other as an it. And therefore, he was against theological dialogue with other faiths. He was in favor of talking to other faiths about things that could be of value to each other, such as things, interests we have in poverty and religion in general, but not to ever discuss religion. So it's an interesting and somewhat peculiar view that he had. One can maintain that to some degree, but and it's a very valid point, but there are many people who are involved in some level of ecumenicism. There's a deep ecumenicism, which is very pluralistic, which he would reject, and of course, which Heschel embraced. In any event, we saw a lot of different readings. I think a lot of them are very beautiful, but many of them were the following. He was trying to use his incredible vocabulary and his appreciation of the world and philosophy of religion and explanation of the human condition, the existential condition, to describe a number of things that are hard to put into words, such as Kedusha, what is holiness, Mesorah, what is a tradition, what is the unique view of prayer, what is the idea of Jewish learning, what is the value in Jewish terms of all this technology stuff and the cosmic quest of modernity, and what is our role vis-a-vis the Gentile community, vis-a-vis our general community, and our relationship with God as described in democratic terms. This covenantal idea is a very democratic idea. It's a very American idea that we relate to God as covenantally, that we're in a covenant with God. Who are we to be in a covenant with God? That, too, is sort of an American kind of an idea. So a lot of his ideas are an effort to put a modern language to ancient concepts. But in many cases, he's an existentialist. He's trying to describe the human condition. Therefore, when he's talking about prayer, he describes, you know, very beautifully the human being trying to reach out in prayer. And he tries to justify the whole idea of Jewish legalism, which was so derided by Protestants and others, describe it as a way of objectifying the human experience, the religious experience, which is so subjective and which has so many negative pitfalls. So he was really an apologist and a spokesperson for Judaism in the modern era, and he gave it a language which dignified our faith. And then, but he spent most of his time, though, truth be told, on halachic concepts, and I think it's yet to be seen whether we can translate all those halachic conceptualizations that he did in the Talmud, in these blue books, and he taught his students over the many, many years to translate those conceptual concepts into a language that can also speak to others. What's very strange about his philosophy is sort of disconnect. He, take the Lonely Man of Faith, the number of citations from the Talmud in Lonely Man of Faith is limited. It's basically a long sermon of some sort. And yet, he wrote in certain places that the philosophy of Torah should stem not from philosophy books, but from the Talmud itself, from the Halacha, that the ultimate Jewish philosophy is in the Talmud. You can find that in the On Repentance, on Al Tshuva. You find some work where he did on that, but a lot of it was not yet done. He did the halachic analysis of the Talmud. He wrote very flowery kinds of philosophical treatises. And to bring the two together is a work yet to be done. And I believe that some of his students, Rabbi Rosenzweig was here recently in Memphis, Rasher's Rebbe, and others will continue to work on this of what can we really glean the halacha, the philosophy of Judaism from the Talmud itself. So that's a work yet to be done. But in any event, it's a great justification of the non-mystical Judaism of which he was a great heir from his grandfather.
So, this was the most fascinating class ever given.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. On behalf of the Adult Ed Committee, I want to thank everyone for attending, and we were all very moved.
Thank you. Thank you, Steve, for all your organizing. We appreciate it. And we'll be continuing, God willing, next semester. And if you have ideas or proposals or things, you can email me or contact me or contact Steve with different ideas. And thanks for joining us. Thanks to Jason for taping. Thank you.
Thank you, Jason.
Thank you.
Thanks, Robert.
Thank you.